To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod.
Welcome to the Death Panel. Patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show. We truly could not do any of this without you. We are coming up on the 500th episode of Death Panel, and it's absolutely wild to take a step back and think of all the amazing people who believe in this work and make it possible. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We are truly grateful and honored to have you all as comrades. And as always, if you'd like to help us out a little bit more, you can share the show with your friends, post about your favorite episodes, hold listening and discussion groups about the show, pick up copies of Health Communism and A Short History of Trans Misogyny at your local bookstore, or request them at your local library, and follow us at deathpanel_. I'm Beatrice Adler-Bolton, and I'm here today with my co-hosts, Artie Vierkant.
Hello.
And Phil Rocco.
Hi.
And we are back after a week off, and thank you also to everyone for the kind messages and well wishes while I was resting last week. This new medication is pretty fucking wild. Today in particular has been really hard and painful, but, you know, I'm being upfront about how I'm feeling today in case I sound kind of off, but you might be like, why the fuck are you in this recording if you feel like shit and you need to rest? And that's because, honestly, you know, what we're about to talk about today, which is the State of the Union address, which might seem like, you know, torture to put yourself through when you don't feel well. Truth be told, I'm actually really excited because doing this show and having these conversations is truly the only reprieve from this shit that I have. And weeks like last week where I have to take off and rest are actually pretty frustrating because, as I'm sure you'd all guess, recording this podcast is really fucking cathartic. So that's why I'm here today. And today we're going to be talking about last week's State of the Union address, which is a kind of curious American political tradition. So first, I just want to start us off on 50,000 foot views before we dive into the details of what Joe Biden actually said in the speech and sort of the spin and the broader implications and the rest of it. There was some pretty heinous normalization going on that I'm sure we'll get a chance to address. But I think we do have to get going by basically contextualizing and talking about like why it's even worth discussing the State of the Union. This only recently has become a massive live broadcasted focus testing session and media event, essentially a big sales pitch and a very important agenda setting performance and media spectacle. And the whole thing, which was initially actually dismissed by some people, like, for example, Thomas Jefferson, who said that the whole practice was too monarchical, it's still propped up by this illusion that essentially slaps a historical veneer on what is a very contemporary cultural political practice in the United States.
Yeah, I always think about the idea that the president is, in addition to, you know, being the whatever commander in chief of the military and sort of the manager of American capitalism, right, at some level, that they are or have been, and is a little historically contingent, you know, that they have been made to be the vibes manager. And, you know, sometimes sometimes all of those roles like go together, right? And then sometimes the roles, just given the fact that because so much power is like ceded to capitalists, right? You don't actually have full control over the economy, or at least you've delegated some of it. So sometimes you can't kind of manage vibes in the economy simultaneously. But it is, I mean, I think the thing that's like annoying about listening to media reactions to the State of the Union is like, there's still this like historical hangover of like, oh, you know, this big speech that everybody listens to, which is not necessarily true, right? And it's sort of treated as like a means to an end, right? And so people are like, oh, what do you think the effects of this are going to be on like the election or whatever?
Right.
Rather than an end in and of itself, right? It is, I think, like the idea of like, this is a spectacle that is an end in and of itself, is like the gestures of it. And like they're performing some role is how I see it. So like, I guess that's what makes it annoying to listen to like coverage, because I'm like, yeah, okay, like, yeah, I actually don't mind when people talk about like, you know, how fast it was or how long it was or like what everybody was wearing, because that is actually what's important about it, not anything else.
Yeah, I feel like it's particularly appropriate to look at this speech in that context, as the fact that the people who this speech was even for were that media class mostly. I mean, like the message that they were sending out, I think, is largely for the people who are supposed to react to it in some way or another. Mm-hmm. You know, I think honestly, whatever its intentions were, this particular speech, like whatever audience the Biden team think that they're you know, think that they're reaching with this. I do think the only real audience for this is people like, you know, Ezra Klein, really.
Yes, absolutely. Precisely.
Right. Specifically because of the piece that was mentioned in the episode, you know, on how we talk about gerontocracy. But, you know, less specifically, it's basically this audience of people, right? Pundits and politics watchers. And then the audience maybe overflows a bit into just like Biden diehards, if that's a thing, right? I mean, people, are there just people who are just ride or die for Biden?
Well, anyone? I mean, I think the thing is, right, it's opinion leaders, right? Because in the end of the day, like, that's the idea anyway, is that that is who sort of influences public opinion anyway. It's just like a very small set of people. Some of them, it's actually their job. And then some of them, it's not their job, but they treat it as if it were.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's a, well, you know, like, yeah.
And that bears out in what has happened, right? So, you know, in intending to, you know, get Ezra Klein and others to write their little things about how energetic the president was. And we saw this before the State of the Union even happened, right? Like Jeff Zients, execute Zients, former COVID czar and now the chief of staff, was telegraphing to Politico, you're going to see, you know, the most energized Biden has ever been. And in fact, that's been the reaction from a lot of pundits. Ezra Klein himself did, in fact, write a piece headlined, "Fine, call it a comeback," where he basically said, okay, you know, never mind, if Biden can keep this up, then sure, I retract my push to have him step aside. But then, you know, otherwise, no one really watches this shit. I mean, there's a good chance like a large number of people listening to this did, because I think a lot of our listeners follow things very closely. But I would also assume that a lot of people who are listening to, you know, the Death Panel patron feed might not want to submit themselves to the experience of actually watching this whole thing, which is, I guess, where we come in. And I'm not just like being negative about this, like, oh, no one cares or watches this, because I do think, you know, early indications have shown, I mean, I'm someone who definitely is skeptical of polling as an indicator of any kind of like political popularity, but like early polling shows that basically this did nothing among regular people, right? So, but I do think, you know, again, as we've said, what has changed is like things like this Ezra Klein piece, things like, you know, we have the Pod Saves of the World and the op-ed columnists of the world got their little treat, right? They were begging him to like hop on the Vyvanse train for a while and, you know, do a big impassioned speech alongside a bunch of media hits and interviews, and he delivered, right? And nowhere is the sort of reaction more evident actually than in something that happened immediately before the speech. B and I watched the speech on the PBS NewsHour broadcast, actually, and their commentary panel had, of all people, David fucking Brooks on it, who said, I'm just going to roll a clip of what he said, because I think it says a lot about, again, who the speech was actually for, but also about how Democrats are thinking about their, let's call it, lack of popularity right now.
Yeah, well, you know, outside the White House, every Democrat I know, the mood ranges from dread to anxiety to despair. Inside the White House, it's totally different. They're like, we got this. And that we're doing the right thing. We've passed the right policies. We don't really need to change course. We don't want to panic. We don't want those bedwetters, as they call them.
So, first of all, that was like the last thing that was
like
said.
Like right before Biden spoke.
Just David Brooks phoning it in.
Right. Yeah. Like walks into, you know, David Brooks is trailing off as Biden begins his like handshakes and crowd kisses and long march down towards the podium. It was like a very sort of weird juxtaposition. I was like, you know, RIP Irvin Goffman, he would have loved the State of the Union this year. And okay, I mean, the bedwetters framing, there is so much to unpack here, from the, oh, we don't really need to change our strategy, to really this kind of position of infantilization of critiques. There is such a vibe that we've talked about over and over, and I was saying to Artie, this clip is like the perfect example, right, of just the tone of rank, gross paternalism from folks in the Biden administration, particularly towards anyone pushing them from any direction, but particularly towards the left. And I think ultimately it's really kind of like a hyper normalized version of what Goffman talks about in his 1956 book called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, which is, you know, this is the book where it's like all the world is a stage. It's his most influential book, even more so than the one we talk about all the time, which is Stigma. But this is kind of like the classic example of the team sport's performance of impression management, right? And the performance of what Goffman called dramaturgical loyalty, which is like keeping the team members loyal to the team and keeping, you know, everybody on the same page in terms of the performance and where the bar is supposed to be set, right? And so when we think about what the State of the Union is in terms of like event and spectacle, and ultimately as, you know, essentially kind of setting these boundaries around expected behavior and expected topics of discussion, right? Ultimately, the real power of this as a performance for presidential administrations in the United States is not the speech itself and not the audience itself, but these reverberations and the ability to sort of set the terms of what the media coverage is going to be, because this is a media spectacle. Again, this is going to draw out all the commentary. But you have the opportunity, for example, for something like this David Brooks comment to slip in, right? And it gives you such an interesting background on really exactly why this is about this important tone-setting spectacle, sort of presentation of the front stage and the curtain that divides it from the backstage, right? Where you have the idea of, again, playing teams. Teams have expected roles, from Kamala Harris's performance to the performance of the Speaker of the House to the performance of the clapping, the analysis of the clapping, all of the commentators, right? This is actually a much bigger event than just the like immediate spectacle itself, and this sort of way that it connects into the broader media narrative that's going to be surrounding the upcoming election is also just like an important moment to sort of sit and look at, like, what are they trying to pull off and get away with, essentially, at this point? What on the backstage side of things is being held back from the curtain in exchange for these performances of loyalty and, you know, expected behavior?
Well, right. And I think, to be clear about that, like, to say that this is a spectacle, I actually like Bruce Miroff, this political scientist, talks about the entire presidency itself, like as an office, is a spectacle, because there are things that the president does that are like rationally calculated to achieve some sort of end or outcome, you know, bargaining with Congress or managing the bureaucracy. But there is also this function that the presidency has in sort of like regulating collective emotion. It's not necessarily always very good at doing that. I want to highlight that, right? But he describes it as like the difference between like boxing and pro wrestling, that like, you know, it's like this is an event whose outcome is sort of foreordained in advance. Like all of the roles have been prescribed. And that's not as like, in a way, I usually, my gut reaction when I hear that is like, okay, well, that means I don't have to pay attention. Like, right. Like if it's just a spectacle, right, then like it doesn't do. And that actually is the way that the media debate kind of on State of the Unions has gone. Like over the years, people have sort of gotten, whatever, I don't know, I think they've gotten tired of covering them because they're so sort of like repetitive and pat. But and so now, like, the you routinely read like stories like, does it really matter? Right.
Right.
Does it affect anything? And it's like that's actually sort of precisely the wrong question to ask. And if you ask it like that, then of course, you know, you're going to come up with the answer then like, whatever, it's just sort of foreordained, so it doesn't matter. But if you think about it as a spectacle in which the point is not to, you know, just like win the election or, you know, lay out the policy or whatever, but instead to like narrate what politics is, who the good people are, who the bad people are, and like also what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, and also what happened in history, then actually they become much more interesting to watch, in part because you can see, like, for example, okay, it by the way, I didn't read a lot or maybe even any coverage that mentioned this, you know, in like narrating the economy and what people's roles are in it, it's like, oh, like more people have health insurance. I don't know what his line was on that. It was, what is it, more people have health insurance than ever, or something along those lines.
Yeah, more people have insurance today than ever before.
Right. Yeah, right. And just like completely writing out of the history the fact that
the Medicaid unwinding is happening.
Millions and yeah. millions of people getting thrown off of Medicaid, which we talked about sort of extensively before. But the point is, I mean, that's also a nice kind of, you know, indicator that that entire population, not actually important, not necessarily part of the normative economy that the event is meant to project, right?
Right, yeah. And I think another really good example of that is how you have basically every pundit responding to the speech saying, oh, and, you know, Biden hit on abortion so much, or so much of this speech was about abortion, and yet the word itself never said, never spoken, right? Mm-hmm. It's all we're restoring Roe, he did his sort of pot shots at the Supreme Court. And, you know, he literally did the thing, send me a Congress that will restore Roe and I'll restore Roe, etc. So he did essentially do the thing yet again of the Dobbs decision and the overturning of Roe v. Wade is an opportunity to vote for Democrats without saying it quite as explicitly. I do want to return, though, to the specifics of what David Brooks said there, just to touch on it for a second, because this is addressing the, as Brooks calls them, quote unquote, bedwetters. I think it's important to kind of be explicit, as I think be alluded to this, but to be explicit about what that means. There's sort of this idea that has been circulating in Democratic Party circles by a lot of reports that paints, there's kind of two aspects to this, I think. On one hand, the context of bedwetters is sort of saying, stop worrying so much, Biden is going to win, and saying that like people who are worried about him winning or not are simply bedwetters. There's the other context, I think, that is sort of, you know, the context of stop worrying that he's not a good president or stop saying that he's not a good president. Like in the case of the recent Matt Iglesias piece that was called, I think the piece was called Debbie Downer Progressives Aren't Helping, mm-hmm. right? But I think in that clip, you hear David Brooks say of this set of people, again, he says of the attitude within the Biden administration, and this is, you know, according to David Brooks or whatever, so who knows what his situation is, but he's essentially saying, at least he's declaring that he has like personal relationships with people in the White House who are saying, mm-hmm. I mean, what does Brooks say? We don't need to change any policies. Mm-hmm. That's a very, we need to do what we have been doing. And that time is every day. Right.
Yes. Is the vibe. It is every day. I was just about to remind you that it was about that time.
Right.
And that time is every day.
That time is every day.
It is actually also every day.
To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod. You'll get access to this and the rest of our catalog of patron-only episodes, and be the first to get a new patron episode every Monday when it drops. With love, the Death Panel.